Merry Christmas, Happy Hanukkah, Happy Festivus, and welcome back to Booked Up. We have something special to listen to as you gather around the tree, or in my family's case, make plans for Chinese takeout. This is our first meeting of the Booked Up Book Club. This month's selection is The Light We Carry by Michelle Obama. No, we weren't able to get Michelle yet, but we still have a stellar team. Lisa Birnbach, author of the Official Preppy Handbook, E. Jean Carroll, infamous, a Vice columnist, never Trumper George Conway, and the poet and publicist, Ivan Lett. So thanks so much for being here. It's really great to have you all together. You know, this is not, I have to be honest, I don't always read memoirs, but I was drawn to this book by Michelle Obama because I think so many of us admire her as a leader and also kind of have somewhat of a mixed, I guess, ambivalence about one of her most famous mottos that she says, when they go low, we go high. And I don't know, I'm the kind of person who likes to kind of get right down there in the gutter and start rolling around and punching. So I kind of don't know if that's always the right approach, but I absolutely loved this book. I want to ask you, George, what you think, because I don't know that reading a book about reading a memoir of a former, the former president's wife is something that might have been at the top of your bucket list.
No, it wasn't. And not because she's a liberal and he's a liberal or a Democrat. It just struck me, I have an innate skepticism, and I have it in bookstores, with these rows and rows of, you know, self-help, feel-good, mushy books. And this didn't strike me, I mean, you describe it as a memoir, but it didn't strike me as a memoir because as I realized after reading about five pages into it, she had already written the memoir. And the memoir, I was thinking, well, that's the book I actually want to read because I like to read about stories. I like to read about, I mean, it's a remarkable story. I mean, this man came out of basically, and he was a state legislator. And within 6 years, I don't know how many, it was not a very long time,
right,
he became president of the United States. I mean, you really don't, it's just a remarkable story. And she had obviously a critical role to play in it. And, it was a burden on her. And you really think that, I mean, how many stories are there like that? I mean, even among presidents, I mean, you have John Kennedy, but John Kennedy had Joseph Kennedy Jr. and the oil man, and former ambassador, you know, running the show and promoting him. Barack Obama didn't have any of that. And Michelle Robinson didn't have any of that. And so it's like, that was, like I said, damn it, that's the book I wanted to read. This book is like going to be, fluffy and it's not going to be my kind of book. Mm-hmm. And turned out I didn't mind it. I liked it, actually. I liked it for a couple of reasons. One is it's well written. She's a very good writer. And she manages to, even though it's not the biography that I should read, I should go back and read her original book.
That was The Coming, and this is The Light
Coming,
We Carry.
Right?
Right.
And which apparently did extremely well, I saw. And I this is, a, you know, this jumps around and it's about, you know, it's more thematic and it's more of like a self-help and advice book. And it's just, again, it's not my kind of book. It's the kind of book I walk, and I, you know, hundreds of them I roll up like, okay, you know, they're all the same. But I liked it because it was well written and because she's engaging. And she's engaging because she's out there, she's giving this advice, but it's not pompous advice. It's not preachy advice. It's not self-involved advice that you could see, you know, that you can imagine some celebrities, famous people would give, telling everyone, you know, in a narcissistic way how great they are. Quite the contrary, she goes out of her way to point out her concerns and her anxieties, of which there had to have been many, given you know everything that she all the things that she lived through and being thrust into the public realm like that, and it, as someone who, unlike her husband, didn't seek that. So I found it engaging, and I was actually, you know, I mean, and I was also wondering, like, yeah, this is the kind of book that is probably better as a 5,000-word essay, because it's not a biography, but it actually worked. And she stitched it all together in a way that was surprisingly seamless, given how she's bouncing around from knitting to a personal story about a struggle she had to her friendships, and there's just a lot of moving around. But it comes out as seamless and easy to read, and I enjoyed it.
Yeah, and you know, it's funny you mentioned self-help, George, because there are periods of my life when I turn to those kinds of books, but I haven't been in one of those in, I don't know, 20 years. And yet, it turns out I appreciated that and a lot resonated for me. I'm wondering, Eugene, if you had a similar reaction.
Well, my reaction is, George, please write a self-help book. I would love
No. Okay. Jen said I could swear. No fucking way. No.
George, this is Eugene's turn to control your life. Go ahead, Eugene.
Jen, you said let's have a book club. I said, oh, this is fabulous. And then you sent me this hideous Michelle Obama book. I thought, what? Michelle Obama, this is a book club. Well, send me John Steinbeck. I was appalled. And so I open up the book.
Oh, God. What can I just say? This isn't really. You know what, Eugene? Take your drink and head to the fucking door. Okay, so, no, go ahead. Go ahead.
No, she sounds like that. That's the reaction you expected from me, Jen.
So, and then I read the first three pages and I thought, boy, was I right. This thing sucks. I don't care about the fucking.
Okay, wait, hold on. Wait till George is done choking on his Diet Coke and repeat what you just said.
Gene, you're incorrigible. Like, you really are.
Yeah, but there's a but coming. There is a but coming.
Thank you, Lisa.
Because I am an advice columnist. So, of course, I'm like, competitive. I am competitive. Don't be giving me an advice book because I will tell you. And then I got to page 4 and I'm like, wait a minute. And then I got to page 5. And Birnbach is right. I fucking loved this book. I loved it. Look, I underlined it. Look at all these pages. I had them flipped down. Look at the underline. Look, who am I? Am I in high school?
Wait, Eugene, you reverse dog ear your books. It's bad enough to dog ear the top corners, but you dog ear the bottom corners? Who does that?
I just.
Well, so you know whether to look top or bottom, right?
Oh.
I love this book, George.
So why? What did you love? I mean, I did too, but I want to hear from you.
Well, do you want to hear? She explained to me that we're each telling our own stories, but we're telling them on top of all the millions of stories that came before us. And so it's very, very difficult to lead a directed life. And Michelle Obama showed me how to do it. We're writing our own scripts over layers of bullshit. And Michelle Obama had to cut through. Oh my God, the thing, when she arrived on the campus at Princeton and saw these guys throwing frisbees, she thought she had landed on another planet. So I sucked down every word like mother's milk. And I think I became a better advice columnist for reading it. I think I became a better friend. She made a point, Jen and Lisa, who are my dear friends, and George. She said, we have to get together. We can't just Zoom. We have to make plans and get together. Really solid, solid advice. So thank you, Jen, for sending me this hideous piece of shit, which turned out to be a jewel. Thank you very much.
I wish everyone in the world could see the faces that I'm looking at right now. Ivan, you have a poker face, although you did kind of chortle when Eugene started to trash the book. you know, as a poet yourself, as a publicist at Basic, you see all kinds of books. I'm not sure if this is a genre, whether it's a hybrid of self-help and memoir. But what's your reaction?
Well, I found it incredibly validating. Being one of the onlys that she talks about in the book, you know, sort of like Eugene was saying with her experience of arriving on Princeton's campus and experiencing it as a whole new world. I've done that many times over throughout my entire educational and professional career. And, you know, I really thought the book was it wasn't self-help, it wasn't how-to, but I wondered what it could do to make people sort of follow the kind of thematic step-by-step advice that she gives in terms of being ourselves and being a full person. All of this is learning about, you know, the person that you are in here and then living with that person and how other people live with that person out there. Mm-hmm. And I thought that, you know, her advice on being tough, I'll quibble a bit on certain aspects of going high. I think I agree with you there, Jen. But really, just in terms of not hiding ourselves and not pretending to be something that we're not in order to get the things that we want. If you are deserving, you get what you put out into the world, and then there's no reason not to put yourself out into the world as you are.
That one line, it sticks with me when she said, "We only hurt ourselves when we hide our realness away." It turns out, you know, I don't know many people who haven't done that. I mean, part of socialization is always fitting into some kind of community. First, it's your first family, then it can be the group in elementary school and in high school and college, and we try to break away, find our people, whatever that is. But, you know, sometimes because of work, because of profession or what have you, we're in spaces. Like you said, Ivan, you can be an only, but you can be an only in a lot of different ways. And I know that I loved the practice of corporate law in terms of the really interesting puzzles we were working on in the clients. But I, you know, at some point, I couldn't really fully be my real self, which does involve a lot of digression, a lot of wasting time, a lot of being a smart ass. And you know, that's just, you can't build that by the hour. And I know that, you know, so there are lots of different ways. And yeah, do you give up money? But so what? What are you going to do? If you sell your soul, if you don't own your mind and your time, then no amount of things that you can buy, I think, can make that up. So that resonates a lot. Lisa, you've heard us. Are you going to say the same thing, or do you have something different?
No. Well, no. I admire the Obamas very much. But in the run-up to this book, all the pictures of Michelle Obama with different celebrities in different looks made me feel like, oh, well, this is just celebrity and is this just, you know, back rubs that celebrity log rolling. That has nothing to do with the book. I was happy to, I was surprised that this was your first choice, especially when I heard George Conway would be in the book group. But I was...
I'm always trolling, Lisa.
I'm admire kidding. George I'm, Conway, and we've never met before, so this is exciting for me. But I must say, Michelle Obama is kind of a dream mom. And what this book was like was the best version of mothering that I have seen in a long time. And it made me wish I could share this book with my adult children, but that would seem like I was scolding. And I don't think this would appeal to them, but it would be good for them. And what I like, and you just mentioned it, is how she talks so much about realness. Mm-hmm. And Michelle Obama talking about her first trip to Michelle Robinson going on her first trip to Hawaii.
Right.
With, of course, a mindset straight out of the Brady Bunch, a Brady Hawaii, a very special episode. And how Hawaii was not, you know, a lover's romp through Waikiki, but or Annette Funicello, if you're really old, but honestly, you know, minding Barack Obama's grandma and grandpa and watching him take care of people. And I think, as George said, specifically, but, you know, seeing our former President Obama through these stories was fascinating to me. To me, self-help books are like math textbooks. I cannot read them. Or IKEA directions. I cannot read them.
Love IKEA directions and I love math textbooks. It's weird. That's interesting. I mean, no, you're normal.
Chose this book.
That's why you chose this book. But as everybody said, you know, the bits of advice I don't resent because she gives a lot of herself and her realness. And I just feel that her daughters are so extraordinarily fortunate to have her as a mother because she does seem mindful. Now, when she was a first lady and she called herself mother in chief or something, I didn't care for it. There's some of her, as you say, when they go low, we go high. There's some of those locutions that she's come up with that become a little cliched or trite. I could do without, but she is a good writer.
Mm-hmm.
And she seems like just a hell of a great person.
You know, we've all kind of touched on the different bits of advice, and the ones that come to mind the most are starting kind. Her friend's husband who looks in the mirror and says, "Hey, how you doing?" You know, the idea that you would look at a mirror and I don't know all your relationships with mirrors, but it's a very strange relationship, right? It's like, how am I looking? Am I okay to kind of go out and, you know, in the T.S. Eliot way, you know, prepare the face to meet the faces we meet but it's more like, is there something wrong? Like you're looking, is there lipstick on my teeth? Does my hair look bad? How fat is my ass? Like whatever it is, it's not a nice place to be. And the idea that you would greet yourself and see yourself and say hello to that person, as opposed to is there lint on them? Just incredible.
I just heard, I was having a conversation with a friend who read, for reasons that are unclear, the biography of Kitty Carlisle Hart.
Mm-hmm.
And Jen, I'll rely on you to explain to people who she was. She was a musical actress, comedian. She was married to Moss Hart, the 20th century composer of Broadway. She was on a lot of game shows, and she looked like ultimate, coiffed, perfect woman. And her daughter, Kathy Hart, is a very good physician in New York. But be that as it may, Kitty Carlisle looked at herself in the mirror every morning and said, "Kitty, I forgive you."
Well, that sounds depressed.
Well, yes, but it also is kind of... you know, today's a new day. If I drank too
much. Yeah, but hold on. Lisa, you see it as positive, but I'm hearing a little creepiness. Ivan, you made a comment. What's your thought about forgiving yourself in the mirror?
Oh, well, clearly she's done something to offend herself or others, and needing that kind of validation every day, I feel like that means you are going about your day wrongly.
I
saw it very positively.
I liked both sides of it, though. Yeah,
I am somebody who not only regrets everything I do and say, but then relives it.
Oh,
so to forgive yourself in the morning, to me is a good start. I know people who write their goals on mirrors and lipstick and stuff, like I will be a millionaire by 36. I will be a billionaire by, I mean, I think that's a gross use of your mirror. I'd rather say, you know, my child's
well,
like
you know,
shit.
Lisa, I just have to, this something came to my mind, which is it's so funny when you think, you know, about things that you regret and that kind of circle back and just bother you and bother you and bother you. I honestly still regret, and it's this deep, it's, there's something truly wrong with me because you would think a regret would be some way I might have hurt someone or I don't know, but my one of my deepest regrets is a spelling error in my first academic article from 2009 where I spelled rain in, like instead of rain, it's a common spelling error. I spelled it like the, a king's rain or a queen's rain instead of R-E-I-N. I mean, it kills me. There's some other issues. And so I know what you're trying to say, and that seems like a dumb thing. I will go probably like on my deathbed, I'll be like, Jesus, I know what's how it's spelled. I mean, are there things you guys beat yourself up about that you think are, you know, that just don't matter and are so stupid and narcissistic? Ivan, you're nodding. What do you?
Oh, I mean, any sort of minutia, a spelling error, something I said to someone and wanted to correct myself later. I mean, we all go through these things. I didn't want to make it sound as though, you know, there was something too wrong about needing to forgive yourself. I mean, I think we all make mistakes and go through our own processes of reconciliation. I just found it strange that she would perform it as sort of this, you know, morning ritual of beginning the day. Or
yeah, I mean, it's not though. I mean, the way I sounded to me was more not like you forgive yourself because you were going to whip yourself on the back with a belt or something. Otherwise, it's just like today's a new day and we have a fresh start today. And that's the way I kind of, and I think
nice,
that's a
though,
very, well, that's the, I mean, that's the way I look at it. It's like, okay, yesterday, you know, I was a little lazy or I was a little cranky or, you know, I left out one time I left out the word, you know, I wrote, stayed all night, up all night to write, and you can relate to this, Jen, obviously, write an emotion in limine brief that had to be due in the federal district.
Oh, I wasn't that
first
kind of
associate.
Lawyer.
No, no.
I was a regulatory. I know what you mean.
Yeah. But you know what I mean in terms of the, you know, spelling errors.
Yeah.
And
oh,
I left out the word not in like the first paragraph. Because, you know, it was, I put the brief out at 5 a.m. and it was, you know, and it just, the word not, you just, it read really well. It's just, my brain looked over and forgot the not and just missed it. And it sort of changed, you know, 180 degrees the meaning. This was in 1990. I recovered from that. And it's just like, you know, you're going to have these moments where you screw something up or you didn't quite do what you wanted to do that day. And today, you know, you can't, you beat yourself up a little, but then you stop and you move on and you remember
true.
Next time to be a little more careful or whatnot. But you can't, you know, you can't let it get to your head.
I did not hear the Kitty Carlisle story, by the way, and then adapt her practice of forgiving myself every day. I just thought it was so curious that a woman who appeared to be perfect.
Oh, right. That was kind of the point.
Out of place, yes. Not a lip liner showing, nothing, just always gracious and beautiful in her style, would even need to forgive herself.
Well, and, that's the problem, know, though.
But
Lisa, that's the problem. There's a
forgiving herself for not getting the right answer on what's my line, or for having an extra martini. Or,
well, that's the thing. Deliberately, so trying to be perfect is trying to.
Yeah.
What is that tradition? And is it? I don't know what the tradition is, but to make one mistake when you're weaving a rug, so you don't try for perfection in the views of a higher being. I used to avoid that kind of thing. I used to, if I found, you know, back in the day when we had to wear stockings with skirts, remember that? If I had a run in my stocking, I would not change because it made me feel free. Because, well, oh, there's already a run in it. Now I don't have to worry about it for the rest of the day. But I want to circle back to some things in the book. I'll get to knitting in a moment. But, you know, someone just mentioned, it might have been George and Lisa, something about Barack's family. And when she goes the things that she observes, Michelle Robinson observed when she visited them, that they, you know, they all didn't see each other very much because they kind of moved around the world and lived in different places, but they spent a good chunk of the Christmas season together. And there was something later, though, in the book she said, and the reason why this resonated for me is it reminded me a lot of my family growing up, and even maybe today, and this was what it was. She said about Barack's family, "Their family to me appeared like a constellation of stars spread across the sky, each person fixed in an arrangement with the others, the group of them spaced in a five-point pattern that was wholly unique to them." Friends have said to me when they meet my family, it's like we're all a bunch of independent contractors. I don't know, what were your upbringings? You know, E.G., what, you've got a lot of, you have a big family. What was your upbringing in Indiana like? Does any of that speak to you? Sorry, I shouldn't ask you.
You know, each family is like Tolstoy said, each happy family is alike, every unhappy family is unhappy in its own despicable way. And my family, I was raised in the most bucolic, almost fairy tale a place. It was in a, I was raised in a schoolhouse, which was across the road from a little red brick church, which was across the road from a graveyard, surrounded by high woody hills, so far back in the Indiana sticks, you can barely find it on them. It's now on, it's on the National Registry of Historic Places, where I was raised.
Because of you?
Huh? No, because
of you?
Because of the architecture of these three buildings that are in this deal. My mother would open the door when I was three or four and just send me outside. And that's how she raised us.
That was
until
my childhood.
Until we reached the age of reason. And then,
what age is that, Eugene?
Seven. Boy, we started to art. Anyway, so I'm just saying it comes back to the mothering. She raised four very independent kids, and Michelle's mother raised her the same. We owe so much to our mothers. George, I know you've talked about your mother and been very moving about your mother. I remember when somebody said a bad word to her in a parking lot. George, you remember that?
George, yeah, I wrote about that.
Wait, I didn't read about or hear that, but that's
no. I wrote about it once in connection with Trump making that comment about the four congresswomen basically saying somebody should go back to their country. And that was something that somebody had once said to my mother in a parking lot in Marlborough, Massachusetts. And I wrote about that. I mean, in terms of the family, yeah, it's sort of interesting because she really appreciated, you know, the trip to Hawaii was interesting and unique and important for their relationship because their family backgrounds were so different.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, not just the geographic aspect, but she's going to this place that she didn't really understand. I mean, you know, Honolulu, which is actually, you know, it's a city. It looks like it's like a mini Los Angeles. It was that way when I first went there when I was a little kid in the 70s. It's a real city, and it's not hanging out on the beach all the time. It's not Maui. And then you've got this family that is unique. You know, the woman, the mother is an anthropologist who travels around the world and is working on her thesis and is not, you know, she didn't raise him the way Michelle Robinson's mother raised her. I think it's fair to say, and the grandparents really raised President Obama. And then, you know, the whole Kenyan side of the family, which is just a completely different, you know, Kenya's a long way from, I guess, what was Iowa? I don't remember what it was, Canada, where the mother was from. And it just, you know, it's just a very different, you know, as the constellation metaphor is actually perfect. And it was just but somehow it all kind of worked, and he became the unique person that he became because of that unique constellation. And I think that story was very, very, I found that part of the book particularly fascinating because that's how she got to know a different world by getting together with somebody, dating somebody.
Mm-hmm. And she'd grown up in Chicago with her whole extended family, roughly in the same neighborhood.
Right.
And only had gone off to college. Yeah. And she was working. Yeah. She was back there working there. Very different.
Yeah. You know, what I found so interesting, too, was because the Obama extended family or broken and then the constellation treasured their time together so much. And that might have been, I think she said, 10 days a year that they were all mm-hmm. together. They said, "I love you" to one another all the time. And that was not the, to use a popular term, a love language in the Robinson family. Their idea of love was being together. She mm-hmm. uses the word constancy and consistency. I think constancy a lot in the book.
And picking up the father's cane, you know, when it clattered to the floor. Yeah.
That, right.
Yeah.
They were, yes, I think her and her brother's understanding of their father's infirmity and taking care of him and protecting him against the cruel world, that was love. Being together every night was love. Going to grandpa's house for barbecue was love. So that's very interesting. I think that is just for two young people trying to figure something out and coming from such different orientations. And not to mention that Barack Obama was mixed race. So she also, she also had to deal with that. So I think if there is a self-help book here, for me, it's just good relationship advice.
Yes.
Taking your time to get to know someone. I love what she said about how decisive he was. I want to go out with you. I don't want to see anyone else. I will only be here for 8 or 10 weeks. What do you say? I found that very appealing.
It's kind of bold for a summer associate.
And when she was also like, you know, senior to him too.
Right. Right.
But those
he was a summer associate at a law firm, right? Wasn't
it? Yeah, those were the, you know, that's the kind of stuff that went down in the 90s. I remember.
History would be different today if they had been born 30 years later. They would have never met. They would have, you know.
Yeah, that relationship advice, I actually read it out loud to my husband because I think when our relationship has been going well, it was that way. I mean, I think there was something she had said about, I wrote this down about that there's not a playbook. And I think, you know, there's some people who maybe, you know, whether you go to couples therapy or whether you have gone to any, you know, people who've gone to these seminars on marriage, I guess those were more popular 20 years ago. But I liked how she said that they don't have any rigid principles and they try to just work out between us that they're two intensely specific individuals. That was interesting. And also the little things that she hinted at about what the other would criticize. Oh, I'm sorry. She mentioned they had done couples therapy, which I thought was pretty bold.
The other thing I thought was interesting about her description of their relationship was they don't try to dump everything on each other.
Right.
Because it's that is a failing, I think, in many relationships where mm-hmm. you just dump everything, all your anxiety on one person and you got to spread it. It's too much. It's too much. It puts too much, because it suffocates the other person. The other person has to come back with you. It's just, and it's a burden. And, you know, her description of relying on both of them, relying on their friends to, you know, bounce things off of so that they don't overload each other is, I thought that was a very, useful observation that a lot of people should take to heart.
And even, you know, she seems to be very extroverted, really is good about making and keeping friends. I mean, look at how she does that. And she recognizes that, what did she say, that he likes to live lightly within a high degree of flexibility and space to think. I'm a lot more like him in that way. But you have to know, you know, respecting your partner. I mean, as you're saying, they can't be the one all be all for you, and neither can any particular friendship, too. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it takes a while to learn that, I think, in life. I have to talk about the knitting, though, because I love knitting, and I turn to it especially when I'm feeling stuck or depressed. And it looks like she only learned how to knit during COVID, and she's a much better knitter than I am. I saw in a photograph she was like using three different needles to sew socks or something. Ejin, you're a knitter. What are your thoughts on this?
Well, I love the girl. She says, you know, she reduced the hugeness of the tragedy going on around the country and the world. Reduce that hugeness down to the smallest, most pleasant, most delightful, most creative thing she could do. And I just want to read her end to the knitting chapter. Maybe it's an itty bitty green hat. You bring a baby shower for a friend. Maybe it's a soft crew neck sweater you give to your Hawaiian-born husband who gets chilled easily in the winter. Maybe you've turned out an alpaca halter top with pretty coiled straps that look perfect against the beautiful brown skin of your 19-year-old daughter as she smiles, grabs the car keys, and rockets past you, out the door and off into this chaotic and never complete world. And just for a minute or two, you can see that it matters, that what you've made is exactly enough. Is that not amazing?
Mm. She can write, boy.
She can write, but it's also a very simple way of living life.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And it's simple, but it's also beautiful. You know, you find the things that make you complete or help you to find that completion, and you hold on, you engage with them. Those are the things that you should be doing. Mm-hmm. So say I.
And it's so important in this era where she mentions this at one point in the book about where everybody is buried in their phones and we're overloaded with information and we're siloed playing video games on the phone or texting and looking at doom scrolling. It's important for that kind of basic, you know, we were meant to be simple creatures, frankly.
Right.
The 21st century isn't really great time it's the best time in some ways to be a human being because we've never had so many things available to us, technically and technologically, but it's not the way human beings were really designed to live. And then the knitting was really, you know, it was a nice way to sort of, you know, remind us all that we need little basic things that are simple to ground us.
Yeah.
What are those things, I want to ask you, George, and since Ivan said that's a way to live, maybe we'll go around and say, what is this sort of unplugged things that are small but really make you happy in your life?
Strumming a guitar, for example. I picked up the guitar a couple of years ago after having not played one for decades. I mean, and that was partly because COVID, like Mrs. Obama. And, that had a great deal of calming and gave me a lot of satisfaction. Also, my little puppy now.
The corgis.
The corgis, yeah.
Oh, so.
So, George, you're calling them. I noticed this isn't the first time. You're so respectful. President Obama and Mrs. Obama. The rest of us are like, Michelle, Barack. I admire that. I should probably be more formal and polite.
As opposed to the former guy?
Yeah. Ivan, what were you going to say?
Oh, I was going to harp on, you know, all of the kinds of arts and entertainment that seem to fill whatever free hours I have, although that's really mostly brought on to me by all of the technological complications that George mentioned. But something I found really, it wasn't new to me from the book because I've seen some articles pop up on this recently, but when she cited a survey about how, what was it, something like 20 to 30% of Americans say they have, you know, fewer than three close friends or really any at all. I mean, I'm always appalled to hear that kind of thing because who are you talking to?
Right.
If not your friend.
People who answer the phone?
I assume so. But, you know, if we're all sitting here around and, you know, in our cell phones and just sort of scrolling through things and not actually engaging with people beyond, you know, some sort of meta connection. I mean, it actually is frightening to me, the idea that so many people don't have friends.
And you look at kids today, right? These kids, because of the social media, Snapchat, Instagram, my kids know hundreds of other kids.
Yeah.
And are in communication with hundreds of other kids in schools, different schools throughout Washington, D.C. or North Jersey, wherever they are. And they keep in touch with them. It's like, you know, when I had a third grade friend named Gary Smith, he moved away. I never heard from him again.
Right.
Right. We only had us.
Do you want me
people.
To find Gary Smith for you, George? I can find anybody.
Gary Smith is really hard with the name is just not.
Well, you know, later were, you'll give me you know, the information. I will find
yeah,
him.
Yeah, you start from me. But anyway, we didn't have as many friends. Okay.
Right.
But when you have that many people you're scrolling and talking to, it's got to be superficial.
No. Mm-hmm.
And that's the nature of the problem today. That's the nature of the problem today is the lack right. of closeness and the lack of community. And that's part of, I think, you know, the disease that we have in this country yeah. that we face.
As a mom, I was not really hurt, but maybe hurt is the closest to what I was feeling when I realized that my children's friends and I would be left out of the equation, as opposed to when I was growing up and I call my friend on the phone and her mother would answer the phone. Hi, Mrs. Taylor. This is Lisa. Can Nancy come to the phone, please? And right. there was a whole dynamic where your right. parents knew who your friends were, where you knew your friends' parents and family and siblings. And there was a warmth to that entirety and community, which doesn't exist anymore. And a kid on a cell phone or a laptop doesn't know their 200 friends on Facebook. They don't know their parents or siblings. They don't know their story. They don't know anything. It is a lonelier version of friendship than is healthy. And as George said, entirely superficial. And I remember when I used to take my kids to their school dances, people didn't really dance. What they did was exchange emails and phone numbers. And it was sort of the cool
thing. Lisa, some of us didn't really dance. We stood by the side of the gymnasium waiting for someone to come over.
Well, that was
wallflower, huh?
Yeah, that was me.
I think what this book is trying to show us, though, is that you should be the one to get the party started if you want to dance.
Oh,
and that's
you're right.
That reminds me of the story
I learned
that
to
I
do
like
that.
The
you're
most.
Right.
The story I like the most in the book, I know this is an odd story to pick out, is Michelle, Mrs. Obama, making friends with Danielle, her daughter's playmate's mom.
Yes,
who had to drive into the drive into this onto the South Lawn driveway and was told by the Secret Service, "You shall not get out of your vehicle," And then when Mrs. Obama comes down, the tactical team with their their M15s come out, and she's kind of gingerly gets out of the car after having washed the car and done her hair, and they started to they started to have a real human being conversation. When mm-hmm. in fact Mrs. Obama wasn't actually supposed to go down there; she's supposed to send the butler or the usher down with the kid. I thought that was a great story, and it was a lovely story of trying to make connections in a circumstance where it's really hard. It's isolating to be in that building.
Yeah, I was thinking about what it is to raise children in the public eye, and she was so fortunate. They both were fortunate that Michelle's mother came to live with them, and she is. We haven't talked about her, but she is. Kind of a star.
A pistol. She's a pistol.
Have you met her, George?
No, but I through the book, I feel I know her,
She's no bullshit. She's totally real. I think one of my favorite things was she had her bedroom upstairs in the White House, and she was invited to any of the fancy events, but she was like upstairs having her meal, watching her shows, not impressed by all this traffic. And I love that. She's very real. I think it really helped those kids, for sure, lead normal lives. There was this other thing before we kind of wrap things up that I was so amused by. It's that sort of contrast between, what is it to be a parent, but what is it to be in your other roles? And all of us who have kids know what that is. How we, how do our kids see us? Who are, what hat are we wearing? And it was when both of his daughters their daughters are in California. And here's what Michelle said. When they moved to California, he, meaning Barack, emailed them a lengthy article about earthquake preparedness and offered to have Secret Service give them a natural disaster response briefing, parentheses. This was met with a polite, "No thanks," close parentheses. I literally laughed out loud by that because it's such a typical how my kids treat me,
But thankfully they knew how to make martinis.
Yes.
Yes. But they didn't have any coasters, did they?
They had their priorities. You got to give
steak knives for girls who don't eat meat.
Right.
And coasters.
So overall, I this made me a happier person. I agree with this thing that she said, that gladness is nourishing. I love the way she, in addition to the sort of message about, Ivan said, we get that party started. We can make our own happiness. She also talked about expanding the sphere of, what was it? The sphere of belonging. She's one of these people. My friend Connie Schultz says this, women who lift while they climb. This is someone who seems so understanding of the struggles, everyday, ordinary, and the complex systematic problems that get in everyone's way. And, she can, on the one hand, work toward change, but in the meanwhile, kindness goes up.
No bitterness. Yes. That's the thing that I loved about the book.
Yes. Yeah. It's corrosive. So any last words, my friends?
Yeah, I like this book club, Jen.
I think just on that point of...
Thanks, Eugene.
Yeah,
I'll bring snacks. Just put your requests in. I don't have anything.
it really should be the martini in a water glass next time. But I just wanted to, what you were saying about how she lifts people up as she climbs. I just really wanted to echo something that Trevor Noah said on his final hosting day of The Daily Show, and saying, listen to Black women. Because I think, someone like Michelle Obama, who has been through, many different kinds of scenes, whether it's the South Side of Chicago or Princeton or the White House, she has perspective to bring on how to lead a happy and healthy life and how to build happy and healthy communities. I mean, that's really what bringing mm-hmm. this life forward is, I think, intended to do for all of us. Maybe I'll have to get the answer another time, but I am very curious as to what brings the light out in each of you, or voluntarily or involuntarily. I have to confess, a Kelly Clarkson song will automatically bring the light out of me and you will see me shine for the rest of the day. But other people have their own sorts of things that they use or touchstones that they go back to in order to find that kind of confidence and that kind of projected strengths that I think that she's advocating for.
What Kelly Clarkson song is your favorite, Ivan? Or can you think of one?
That's a hard one. Well, Behind These Just Hazel Eyes absolutely is my
Which
favorite.
One?
Behind These Hazel Eyes.
Okay. That's such a good question. What brings a light out? Lisa, what brings a light out in you?
I believe it's my children and my grandchild. I notice now when I'm with a kid and my kid or exhibits, as I like to refer to them, because they're science projects that actually sort of worked, to my shock, I like to pat them. I just can't take my hands off them.
So sweet. How about you, George?
I think irony and humor. I think is the thing that...
And kink?
What?
What?
What did you say?
Irony and humor. I didn't say kink.
I heard irony and kink that I thought,
let's unpack that, Lisa.
Lisa, there was... Eugene, I don't know what to say. What is going on here?
I love
secret,
it.
Secret,
I love
it.
Yeah, what's with your friend here?
Well, I gotta say, you know,
Eugene, what brings the light out for you?
The light, Lisa Birnbach brings out the light for me. She's my best friend, and when I'm down, not feeling well,
we take care of one another.
Lisa Birnbach stands up and takes care of.
Oh, I love that woman.
You know, I think for me, it's a kind of it's laughter, but it's also, laughter among friends. I think it's really, I think that's definitely the thing. And of course, books. That's why we're here at Booked Up. Anyway, today is the perfect day for this conversation about light because it is Christmas. And the seventh night of Hanukkah, the lights are still burning. And I hope we all can, bring this feeling and remember supporting others and ourselves and letting our light shine because that light increases as we come into the new year. Thanks, friends.
Thank you.
Pleasure reading with you.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for listening. I think we covered a lot of territory with Michelle's book without too many spoilers. But there was this one thing that I didn't ask about because it really wasn't a question, it was a comment. And it's this. I read and learned something completely new. And I just wanted to share this little juicy bit of information with you to get a sense of the other Easter eggs in this book. Michelle wrote that she just found out that, quote, statues of mermaids outnumbered statues of female members of Congress by a ratio of 11-1. How about that? So this was our first book club, and we've already selected the book for January. It will be the official report of the Select Committee to investigate the January 6th attack on the Capitol. Thanks for tuning in. Enjoy the holidays and have a happy new year.